to talk about.
May it please the court, my name is Garrett Rasmussen. I represent the Cherokee Nation. I'm going to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The district court's holding of no sovereign immunity should be reversed for four reasons. First, the Treaty of 1866 does not abrogate the Cherokee Nation's sovereign immunity. Second, there is no implied abrogation, either as a matter of law or a matter of fact. All the surrounding circumstances show that the parties intended to preserve the sovereign immunity of the nation, not abrogate it. Third, there is no abrogation in the 13th Amendment or in any enforcement legislation under Section 2 of the 13th Amendment with respect to the plaintiff's actions. And fourth, the nation's sovereign immunity cannot be circumvented by suing the chief when the relief in substance is against the nation.
Assume for a moment that you're right about all of that.
Yes.
Why can't this action continue in the district court against the Interior Department?
Because the Cherokee Nation is an indispensable party.
Why?
Because the relief.
The only relief they're asking for is for the Interior Department to exercise its responsibility under the principal chief act.
Well, the district court has already ruled that we are a necessary party because citing.
I'm asking you whether
yes.
That's correct.
I think it is correct.
Why this case can't proceed just as an ordinary administrative law case in the district court?
Because it involves fundamental sovereign rights of the nation. The nation has intervened. It has a right to intervene.
That's a separate question. Sure, the nation could intervene in that action. But why is it indispensable to the question of whether the Interior Department has exercised its responsibility under federal law?
I think, Judge Tatel, that once we intervene, which we have a right to do.
Well, you're just stating the conclusion. I don't understand
right.
Why that's. I understand why you have a right to intervene. I don't understand why this case can't pursue. It's just a normal, continue. It's just a normal administrative law case against a executive branch department.
Because
who it is alleged is not fulfilling its responsibility under federal law.
Because if the executive branch does not enforce, does not recognize the election, then the nation is paralyzed. And thus it takes affirmative action of amending its constitution and changing its citizenship requirements and changing its voting requirements. The nation would be paralyzed.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, if I just follow up on Judge Tatel's question. The Seventh Circuit held in a case called Thomas versus United States, where really it seems quite similar. The issue was an election, an Indian election.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was an amendment to the Constitution which redefined tribal membership in terms of lineal descendancy rather than blood. And the same claim that the tribe was a necessary and indispensable party was made. And the court said, that's not the case. This is not actually a case of tribal self-government because this question of approving elections
right.
has been placed in the hands of the secretary. And that under those circumstances, this doesn't come under Rule 19. Of course, the tribe can intervene if it wishes to
yes.
defend itself. But it's not a necessary party. It's just an ordinary APA case. Now, how do you distinguish that case?
I don't distinguish it. I disagree with it. I think the reasoning may be incorrect, Your Honor, because the relief is inevitably going to affect what the one of the core sovereign, the most fundamental core sovereign issue of the nation, which is its ability to define itself.
But it doesn't have the power to define itself. The power to define itself is in the treaty, and that's given to the secretary. Then there's a Dawes list.
Right.
Those things are outside the authority of whether they can be sued directly by a plaintiff is a different question.
Right.
But there's no question that under the treaty that it's not totally up to the tribe to determine its membership. Isn't that right? Forgetting about whether there's an independent cause of action, isn't it true that the treaty takes some elements of tribal membership out of the authority of the tribe?
That is correct.
So then this is not purely a question of tribal sovereignty.
It's not purely a question of tribal sovereignty, but it certainly implicates tribal sovereignty very directly. The tribe, therefore, sought to intervene. Its motion to intervene was granted as a necessary party. That issue has been resolved.
If you don't have to be a necessary party in order to intervene.
No, you have to be necessary and indispensable.
No, in order to intervene,
you have to be necessary.
Have permissive intervention. You don't. It doesn't have to be.
Correct.
You don't have to be a necessary party to be able to intervene. You just have to have a significant interest in the outcome.
But here there was a ruling that they were a necessary party, which is not an issue which is currently before this court.
I realize it's not a question before the court. That's why I started my question to you by saying that.
Right.
I was trying to understand the implications of your argument. If you're, I was simply asking that if you're correct about the tribe's sovereign immunity,
correct,
why this action can't continue. I think we've probably, against the Interior Department, I think we've probably exhausted that.
Right. And, you know, I was not prepared, I must say, for the question you asked, Judge Tatel. I think if I had more time to think about it, I might come up with better answers, but it's really not the issue that
I thought was
before the court. I did want to also make one fundamental point before I start addressing those four points, and that is that this case is not about the color of the plaintiff's skin. It's not about the fact that they are descendants of former slaves. The Cherokee Nation has more than 1,500 former descendants of former slaves who are voting members today, and it has thousands of more African-American members. In fact, the Cherokees is the most diverse of the Indian tribes. What this case is about is the treaty rights, which the plaintiffs have their purported claims arise. The treaty sets forth not only the substantive rights, but the remedies. And in Article 13 of the treaty, the article provides for exclusive jurisdiction in tribal courts, except provided elsewhere in the treaty, and there is nothing else in the treaty that provides an exception for this case. And remember, this is not an issue of Congress's intent. It's an issue of actually the tribe's understanding when it negotiated the treaty. It's a negotiated document, and there's a canon of construction that says we must defer to what the tribe reasonably would have understood in that treaty.
What's your strongest argument on the ex parte Young? If we were to agree with you that the tribe has sovereign immunity here, why shouldn't this case proceed against the tribal officers under ex parte Young?
Because the relief sought, Judge Griffith, is in substance relief against the nation.
That's always the case.
It's always the case, but here the relief sought would be that
we live with the fiction, right?
Yes, but that's the conclusion. But the analysis is that what the relief would do, it would paralyze the nation. It would stop the nation from having any elections unless the nation took affirmative steps to amend its constitution.
And that distinguishes us from what other cases under ex parte. That's what always happens.
No, I think it's actually directly on
point. You start with Larson. Is that your strongest argument, that ex parte Young does not apply here?
There's Larson and there's Hawaii v. Gordon. Hawaii v. Gordon talks about if the relief affects the public administration of government.
Well, how is it different than Santa Clara?
Yeah.
In Santa Clara, the court...
It was denying tribal membership to the children.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
So, and the court said that, ex parte Young applies.
The court said that in one sentence, Your Honor, without analysis.
Normally, we don't measure the Supreme Court opinions by how many sentences.
But it does seem different than the Supreme Court's recent decisions in Idaho and in the Idaho.
Well, if you're going on recency, how does it beat Verizon?
Well, in Verizon, I think, is a standard ex parte Young application. That was a rate commission. The rate commission. Judge Rehnquist said that when a state regulator under the Federal Deregulation Act acts in a manner inconsistent with that act and the relief sought is an injunction, nothing requesting affirmative action, which is what Larson was talking about. If you're seeking affirmative action to compel a nation to take affirmative action, as in substance the relief does, then we're squarely within footnote 11 of the Larson case.
So with respect to any element that can be defined as prospective injunction, from now on, do not discriminate with respect to voting, with respect to the plaintiffs, you're saying that they could bring an ex parte Young claim. Is that right?
You repeat that question again to make sure I understand it.
If the difference has, I'm not sure what you mean by affirmative action. Obviously an injunction, nor do I know what the Supreme Court meant. But whenever you have an injunction, you're requiring someone to do something.
But I think what the Larson Court was talking about when it was distinguishing between affirmative requirement that the state do something and a nation do something, and negative is that if it requires the nation to take to legislate, to do something of significance that affects sovereignty, I think that if these cases mean anything, if Hawaii v. Gordon means anything, if Larson's footnote 11 means anything, it's got to mean that when the relief requested is to require an amendment of a nation's constitution to change both its membership and its voting rights, if that's not a central sovereign
issue. It's prohibiting that recent amendment from having any effect.
But the relief sought is not to recognize any election until the
that's right.
rules are changed.
Well, you can have no election if you don't want to, but it says you cannot have an election inconsistent with the treaty, and that's it.
But surely, Judge Garland, that's affecting the administration of
the same is true in Santa Clara. You know, we don't like
the same is true in Santa Clara, right. But I think Santa Clara was decided well before the court's opinions in both.
Well, no Supreme Court opinion has said it's overruled, right?
That is correct.
And, you know, the Supreme Court has told us about 25 times that if it wants to overrule its own cases, it's up to it, not right. up to us.
Right.
So what do we do about that? And we have Verizon, which is appears to, you know, its interpretation of Coeur d'Alene is simply that it doesn't, you know, the ex parte Young is back in the saddle.
I mean, well, I think what Judge Rehnquist was trying to do in Verizon was to try to rein in courts that were trying to get around ex parte Young much too easily. I think ex parte Young is a vastly, I mean, I think the Verizon case is so very different, purely seeking to stop. And
Larson's different too, right? It was a federal contracting officer. There was no claim that the officer was doing anything unconstitutional. That's the heart of ex parte Young, right?
Right. But of course, the
claim here is that the tribal officers are doing something unconstitutional.
Right, but I would direct you to the Hawaii v. Gordon, which I think is actually our strongest
case. The property
case,
right?
Property
cases are different.
No, it was a case in which the director of the budget, the relief was to try to require the director of the budget to rescind his opinion to another agency and therefore change government policy. And that was the relief, I think, at issue in Hawaii v. Gordon. And then, Judge Griffiths, there's also the Fletcher case, which we rely heavily on, the Tenth Circuit case, in which involved voting rights themselves, and the court held that that because the relief requested concerns right to votes in future tribal elections would be granted, if that relief were granted, it would run against the tribe itself, and the tribe's sovereign immunity protects, in that case, tribal officers. I think what distinguishes this case from Verizon and what makes it special is that it has the characteristics, I think Judge Rehnquist would see it differently as well. I think if you look at the Idaho decision, there are certain inherent special sovereignty rights, which is what the Supreme Court in Idaho focused on. I think this case has, in spades, it's as close as you can get to, it's the most special of sovereign rights. It's the right to.
But these are sovereign rights that have been, this isn't like land and treasure in the Coeur d'Alene, right, case. I mean, the sovereign rights here have been cut back significantly by the United States since the Secretary has final approval.
Right.
So this isn't the same.
Well, but it's the same in the sense that fundamental rights, what is your reservation? Can you partition your reservation?
It's about an election, right? And the United States has carved up the tribe's sovereign interest in the elections. I mean, it has almost plenary power over the elections.
Well, the treaty.
So it's not like the ex parte Young line of cases that's talking about the exception to ex parte Young. It's talking about treasury or land or disposition of property.
But it is talking about the same fundamental right that was at stake in Fletcher, the same, really, I think, fundamental right that Larson was worried about in that footnote 11 when it said yes.
I don't think Larson helps here. At least it doesn't with me.
Okay. But I think Hawaii v. Gordon does. I think Fletcher does. Okay. I think the Ninth Circuit in Sherman also helps. I think all those are cases in which courts have grappled with the with relief, which nominally maybe can. You know, a careful pleader can always put something in the negative. You can make your relief be negative, and you can and you can word it that way. But I think the court has to look in the substance, and is the substance of the relief trying to force the nation to do something, or is it stopping a runaway chief from acting in a way that is unconstitutional? the chief here, he can't rewrite the Constitution, even if the case goes forward against him. I mean, he can't, on his own, he can't by fiat change the citizenship rules.
No, but the court could, the secretary can vacate the new Constitution, can vacate the changes.
The secretary could. The secretary hasn't done so.
Right. Well, that's what we're trying to get out of the lawsuit.
Right. But then we're back to where we started, which is the sovereign immunity. We have intervened as a necessary party. There may be some issue about whether we're really necessary or not, but so far that's the ruling of the district court. If we are a necessary party, the case can't really proceed.
Putting that question to the side, the court could order the vacation of the new amendment. So if the case is brought as directly, why can't the court order that the relief sought here is vacating the amendment? Is that not possible?
Boy, that's an issue I haven't thought about, and I wouldn't want to comment.
I mean, your only answer, the answer is the one you've been giving all along, which is that the tribe is a necessary party and it enjoys sovereign immunity, right?
Correct, but I mean,
that's your answer.
Yeah, that is my answer, and I don't have really much.
Because if it wasn't for that, then the kind of relief Judge Garland's talking about would be completely appropriate.
Right.
Right, because it would simply be enforcing federal law and a federal treaty.
Correct.
Okay.
So that would suggest.
So it all turns on that question.
I think it turns on the sovereign immunity question.
Can I ask you one quick question about the 13th Amendment with respect to abrogation?
Yes.
What if the tribe were currently holding slaves? Could a slave sue?
A slave certainly could sue the person that was holding him as a slave. He could bring a habeas corpus petition. Mm-hmm. He could bring an ex parte Young action against the state official. Mm-hmm. He could bring a Bivens action against the state official. But Judge Garland, I don't think he can sue the tribe directly.
What if the tribe were holding slaves?
If the tribe were holding,
as a communal entity, were holding slaves. I don't know what I don't know how, in what form the tribe held slaves before the treaty.
I think.
But what if it were?
I think if there were, then it presents an issue which.
You don't think the 13th Amendment would prohibit the tribe from holding slaves?
I think it would, but I think the way it would be enforced is there's always an individual that is the person that is enslaving. There's always the jailer. There's always the individual.
Ex parte Young, right?
And ex parte Young is the solution.
Wouldn't you make the same argument?
Yeah, it's the ex parte Young.
Yeah, but you'd make the same argument that you're making here.
Yes.
That ex parte Young doesn't give you that right.
Oh, no, but it gives you the right.
Oh.
Ex parte Young.
Even if the remedy is, even if.
Oh, but the remedy in Judge Garland's case is to free the slave.
Yeah, but
it's
not
to compel an amendment to the Constitution.
His hypothetical is that the tribe owns the slaves.
And then the relief there is still the tribe must free the slaves, and if the tribe doesn't free the slaves, that's the relief. The tribe must free slaves. That's obviously an important principle, but it's not it's not a core sovereign issue in terms of the tribe's governance. It doesn't do with voting. It doesn't do with membership in a tribe. As the court in Nero held, you know, if these aren't sovereign interests, if these aren't core sovereign interests, then nothing is. I think I'm over my time. I'd be happy to answer any more questions. Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Veeley. I'm here to represent the Cherokee Freedmen. And I'd like to address directly, if I could, Judge Griffith, that Fletcher was distinguished by the district court in its footnote 14, page 27, where it said, however, actions for injunctive or prospective relief against officials are not treated as actions against the sovereign, and cites Hafer versus Mello. So I believe this is a classic application of ex parte Young, and that we could progress against the officials, which is, I think, statement two, or question two of this appeal. This case presents a very narrow issue of whether the Cherokee Nation and its officials still possess sovereign immunity to bar actions of the descendants of former slaves and freed blacks to uphold their citizenship rights against U.S. officials. To distinguish the Cherokee Nation's position, it lost its sovereign right to engage in slavery and determine equal citizenship of the freedmen when Congress enacted the 13th Amendment and ratified the Treaty of 1866. The Supreme Court decided over 100 years ago on this membership issue that except for treaties and statutes, tribes have the right to determine their memberships.
But there's a difference between statutes and treaties that limit the tribe's sovereignty and breaching its sovereign immunity, right?
Well,
I mean, what do you do with Santa Clara Pueblo?
Well, Santa Clara Pueblo, first of all, and I liked it. Okay. Santa Clara Pueblo.
Santa Clara Pueblo says you have to find a revocation of the sovereign immunity in the treaty or the statute.
That's correct.
Okay. And where is that?
Well, I'll be glad to answer that. First, let's state what the district court said and how the court found that. The district court on page 17 of its opinion, Congress's unequivocal intent to limit the nation's sovereignty as a condition of recognition by the United States becomes all the more clear when considered in the context of history.
Right, and there's no question that these statutes and treaties limit the tribe's sovereignty.
Right.
But the question is its sovereign immunity.
I agree, Your
Different
Honor.
Different questions.
All right, and to
the
find...
the first doesn't lead to the second without express language. That's the way I read Santa Clara Pueblo.
Okay, if you read Santa Clara Pueblo, it says if there's express language,
right.
But let me bring up DeCoto, which
and,
I think...
And it'd be helpful to me if you could point to the explicit language.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. But the context of this...
No, I think we know the context. We've read the briefs.
The explicit... First of all, CNL says the language does not need to contain the word sovereign immunity to mean sovereign immunity has been waived. So to establish
so
where the language is, there are a number of articles here. Article 4 grants the freedmen land in the Canadian district and prohibits discriminatory laws against them. Article 6.
So where does that grant the cause of action?
Where
does that limit sovereign immunity?
Okay. Take it. Crystal Energy says that you can look to more than one paragraph. So you can look to these different paragraphs and come to the totality of the circumstances to find that abrogation. And then that's when you bring in the context. And there is case law to support that. So if you look at Article 4, granting the freedmen property rights, Article 6 grants them the right to run for office, Article 9 grants the former slave freed blacks and their descendants all the rights of native Cherokees, Article 12 says no matter what form the Cherokee Nation takes, it shall be bound by the Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States, and Article 13 I think is very important because it provides only limited jurisdiction to the Cherokee courts for actions between Cherokees arising under Cherokee lands.
Sounds like you're making a penumbral argument to me. You can't find anything explicitly, but you're saying putting them all together.
And I believe that's permitted. I think if you look at the Crystal Energy and how they said you don't have to find one particular place, and if you look at CNL, which says it doesn't have to say sovereign immunity, and the reason it can't say tribal sovereign immunity is that doctrine was coined after this. So you have to look at what the intent of Congress is. Now, the intent of Congress was still part of the Martinez analysis. And although Martinez
Did you say sovereign immunity was coined after
the
treaty?
Right. The
concept exists long before the treaty.
Right.
This is something that's in the nature of the tribe, right?
The first case, and Martinez deals with it, is Turner versus United States in 1919. It says sovereign immunity doctrine's been around for a long time, and then goes back, and it's the first case it cites. The Cherokees have made arguments that there are some other cases in other circuits that talk about it. But having the phrase in what tribes understand today and how to waive it and abrogate it is different then. So we have to look at what the intent of Congress was.
Well, let me take you back. Let's stick with the language of Santa Clara Pueblo, okay?
Okay.
It says, because nothing on the face of the ICRA purports to subject tribes to the jurisdiction of the federal courts. Because nothing on the face of the statute. And then it says, in the absence of any unequivocal expression of legislative intent. So you have to look to the face of the statute for an unequivocal expression of legislative intent.
If it is clear. And what DeCoto says, it holds that a treaty and a statutory provision that's not clear on its face may be clear from surrounding circumstances and legislative history. And the legislative history, I think, is very important here because the United States is just ending the Civil War, which it fought for the purpose of abolishing slavery and stopping that everywhere. And if you look at the context, and I believe this is where the district court looked, You look that in, the Cherokee Nation enacted slave codes prior to the Civil War. It regulated slavery.
But I don't think you're going to get much disagreement on the slavery question. But we're not on the slavery question here.
Right. And well, the context, and here's what I believe the court does, and I think the court was proper in finding it, that this context is very important, is that what Congress does leading right up in it, like the 4 months before this, in 1865, it enacts the 13th Amendment. In 1866, it enacts the Civil Rights Act. Then, to make dead sure that there's no pocket anywhere within the jurisdiction of the United States, and tribes are within the jurisdiction of the United States under the their semi-sovereign status, they went to the tribes and incorporated these federal laws into these treaties to make sure that this didn't happen. If you look at Seminole versus U.S. in the Court of Claims, they talk about the purpose of these post-Civil War treaties. And the purpose was to, first, slavery had been abolished, but to enforce the civil liberties of the former slaves. They weren't going to allow nations that had fought on the side of the South to wage war in defense of slavery to be able to do it again. Your question about what if they engaged in slavery again had to be a real issue in 1866, because they had done it. So how do you stop the states, and how do you stop these other governments? Well, we have this federal law. Let's go to the tribes, dicker a negotiation. And that negotiation was, these will have all the same rights as every other Cherokee. They'll have voting rights. And if you have causes of action, that you can have them when it goes to just these actions between Cherokees. But this is not an action between Cherokees. It's against the United States officials. The only court that can hear an action against the United States officials is in this action, right here in the district courts. That's under Article 3. So this is outside of that. And the 13th Amendment applies to Indian country. It does under In Re Sakwa, and it does under Choctaw Nation versus U.S. And it comes down to the point, does the Cherokee Nation still have this sovereign right to determine the membership of these treaty-protected people? It does not. They do have the sovereign right, and sovereignty is about retained rights. The tribes retain a lot of rights. They retain the right to determine their membership, just not on the descendants of former slaves. That was treated away. And that was ratified by Congress, and the 13th Amendment prohibits slavery and badges of slavery.
Is it Article 9 is the closest with respect to the membership question?
Absolutely. Yeah, although the other articles above talk about property rights, and I believe a lot of those are what were the context in the Court of Claims cases, why they would have property rights as far as civil rights, and a number of cases throughout the years have done that. And I think it's important to look at these issues have been resolved and resolved in the 1890s and 1910s and 1930s and 1960s, that these folks have all the same rights as the other Cherokees do. And I believe even the Court of Appeals, even before it was called that in 1912, dealt with this in Catoosa Society versus Lane and said, this issue is over. But it keeps raising its head every few generations, and that's why we're back again.
Could you address the ex parte Young issue?
I believe I did, but I'll go it again. That ex parte, this is a classic example of ex parte Young. Mm-hmm. And the Fletcher case is the case that the Cherokee Nation raises that that says it shouldn't because it runs against the issues.
But what about they made the arguments about, you know, Larson and Seminole Tribe and Coeur d'Alene. How would you distinguish those?
Well, again, I think the district court does a good job of it by using Haffer versus Mello and says, however, actions for injunctive or prospective relief against official are not treated as actions against the sovereign. I think that's the classic example.
And what's your response to the affirmative action language of Larson footnote 11?
I don't know how to answer that, to be honest. Okay, so...
Can I just ask, is everything solvable by prospective injunction?
I think we're looking for a declaratory judgment that I think would answer this and put it to bed. I think your questions to Your Honor, to opposing counsel, were right. I think that if the judge said that the treaty states that these folks have all the rights of Native Cherokees and you can't impose a law that violates that treaty and the 13th Amendment, then there we have. I think it respect the fact the Cherokee Nation has a right to determine lots of issues, but it does not have the right to expel or infringe upon the civil liberties of the descendants of former slaves. I think that has been solved a long time ago.
So even if the tribe enjoys sovereign immunity, And even if the tribe is correct that the administrative case against Interior cannot go forward without the tribe, can you get all the relief you need from the Ex parte Young action against the officials?
We'd obviously like the tribe to be told in his action that it cannot violate this treaty. But we initially sued the United States over this, and we sued the United States because they had defended the rights of the freedmen before. And if they're instructed by a court that they have to continue because they have a fiduciary duty to protect the freedmen as they did in the Seminole freedmen expulsion matter, then that probably would give us the result we need. But I believe that the Cherokee Nation is here. They've entered the case. I think they are a necessary party, but not an indispensable party. I think there is a distinction of the court.
I have a question about the record. Maybe you can answer it.
Okay.
It's the August 6th letter from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's at Joint Appendix 199.
Okay.
Up until then, the department had been taking the position that it had to approve the procedures for the election, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Now suddenly, with this August 6th letter,
right,
it never mentions it. Do you know why they changed their position?
I believe it had to do with a little of lobbying, Your Honor. I got to go through the Seminole matter first and then through this one, and it was quite shocking because the same attorneys were involved in all of this, and those folks had defended the rights of the Cherokee freedmen when there was an election to expel them from the tribe. They said it was a violation of the 1970 Principal Chiefs Act because it reconstituted the tribal government, and under that act, because they had to look out for the elections of the principal chiefs, those had to be approved by them, that they were in violation, and they immediately acted on that. In this situation, when the Cherokee Nation asked for permission to amend its constitution, Neil McCaleb was ahead. He said, you can do so on three conditions. Of course, you can take the United States oversight out of your constitution, but the freedmen must be able to vote. Number two, if you amend your constitution, you can't later vote them out. And number three, the 1970 Principal Chief Act applies. That was in the same year, 2002, that the second of the Seminole Nation versus Norton cases came down. So when the tribe has its election for the Principal Chief and for the constitutional amendment, it does not permit the freedmen to vote. So we, of course, complain to them on that, and initially they take the action that is identical to the Seminole matter, and they cited Wheeler, and Wheeler says that the U.S. cannot intervene into an election unless a statute specifically tells them to. Well, the 1970 Act does exactly that, and the Cherokee's position was, well, we don't have to answer this. We've never answered it before. And the numerous letters came out saying, you need to answer it, you need to answer it. And all of a sudden, we get a reversal. And that's what caused us to go to court on this matter, because they flip-flopped on their situation.
Can you, I'm just thinking on the remedy question again. You haven't yet had to appeal the question of whether they're a necessary and indispensable party, right?
That's correct.
Not interlocutory. If they were a necessary and indispensable party, on your theory, well, let me put it another way. In the end, is a declaratory judgment by the court enough, or isn't this a question that, in the end, depends on the action by the secretary? And does the statute basically put this in the secretary's hands? Would the court have to force the secretary to do something?
I think the court probably has to force the secretary to do something, because the secretary just isn't doing that, and they know that they should.
I'm going to put it another way. Could the court order, this is the discussion we were having before.
Right.
Can the court direct any of its remedy at the tribe as compared to having to direct its remedy against the United States?
I believe it can, because I think that the tribe no longer has sovereignty or sovereign immunity
over
this issue.
Even if it does, there are a bunch of statutory provisions putting authority in the secretary to approve or disapprove amendments to the constitutions, et cetera, right?
Sure.
Can the court go around those by directing the tribe directly, or does it have to order the United States government to reconsider the question, or in the end, mandamus it to do something? You understand what I'm asking? Is a remedy aimed at the tribe really useful here? Doesn't it have to, or appropriate here, forgetting about immunity and Ex parte Young? Isn't the defendant who's really necessary here the secretary?
Obviously, the United States is necessary. I think it's very useful, if that's the word you used, and probably appropriate that the officials of the tribe and the tribe itself be stated by this court that they're bound by this treaty and the 13th Amendment and can't violate it, because I think the question that the tribe is raising is very dangerous. The tribe is raising...
You're not quite...
Okay. I'm sorry.
You may be following the question, but then it's not the question I'm asking.
Right.
The ultimate remedy you need is to have this change in the Constitution disavowed, vacated, right?
Correct.
Okay. Can you get that, forgetting about the immunities, and imagine there were no immunities and no ex parte Young issues here at all.
Right.
Can you get that under the statute by directing your remedy against the tribe, or don't you have to direct the remedy against the secretary to do something to the tribe?
You definitely have to direct the remedy against the United States.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then maybe ex parte Young doesn't matter. In the sense, it doesn't matter whether it's prospective or retrospective, because in the end, you don't really want, or it's not helpful to you, to get an injunction against the tribe. You've got to get an injunction against the secretary, who doesn't have any sovereign immunity of any kind here, because
right.
the APA waives it.
That's correct.
So maybe the ex parte Young issue is irrelevant here.
I believe what the court is saying that the entire issue of the tribe moving in is fairly irrelevant to the deal. I mean, we understand these are important issues.
That issue is not before us. We were just asking about it.
Right.
The question's not here. And if the tribe is correct, let's assume that they're right about the tribe's sovereign immunity. If they're correct that they're a necessary and indispensable party, then you can't get any relief against the secretary.
That's their position, yes.
Right. So maybe that's why you need it. I mean, whether you need ex parte Young then turns completely on the answer to that question,
right.
which isn't before us, right?
Right. What's before you is whether or not their sovereign immunity right. still extends right. to bar this action. And
if it doesn't,
then we can have the action against the United States.
I guess what I'm asking is, assume for the moment that the tribe actually does have sovereign immunity.
Okay.
Would ex parte Young, and assume that an action against individuals would be no immunity because of ex parte Young. Would that really get you where you have to get to, because an injunction against individuals won't really help? You need something against the tribe. You need something against the secretary against the tribe.
It would definitely foreclose the issues that could come up down the road if they were not permitted to go forward.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Does counsel have any time? Okay, you can take 2 minutes if you'd like.
Thank you, Judge Tatel and panel. I want to address the ex parte Young issue and try to address it better, Judge Garland, your question. In addition to looking at the cases that I suggested, I think Seminole v. Florida is instructive here as well. In Seminole v. Florida, the Supreme Court said that if Congress, in that case, passing an act, prescribed a scheme of remedies that was more limited than ex parte Young provides, then the presumption is that ex parte Young doesn't apply because Congress has thought about the issue and carved a lesser relief. Now, that I think that applies back to the 1866 treaty, even though ex parte Young wasn't a case then, because what it instructs is we want to look to the intent of the parties, and that's a treaty, so we have to look to the intent of
You're saying the 1866 treaty creates the remedial scheme?
Yes, I think it does, because it actually addressed the issue in Article 13, where it provided for exclusive jurisdictional tribal courts. And indeed, that's another remedy, Judge Garland. These plaintiffs could join the other plaintiffs in the tribal court
litigation. I just think that Verizon wipes out this argument on your part. It says that the Seminole's discussion really requires a detailed and exclusive remedial scheme like the one in Seminole Tribe, which had many different layers in it, and it rejected that argument in Verizon because there was just a one-shot provision like the one you're talking about here.
But it's one-shot, but it is actually stronger than the complex relief in Seminole, because it was an absolute grant of exclusive jurisdiction to the tribe, and therefore what can trump that? A more complex one that gives partial lawsuits under this provision or that provision is more complex, but here Congress has been even more, not Congress, the parties to the treaty have been even more definitive. They said it's got to be exclusively in tribal courts, and the tribal courts is a fine remedy. But let me stick with ex parte Young, because my time is limited. I think relief against, if you were to allow the the case to proceed against the chief. I think the tribe would still be an indispensable party, would move to intervene in that case, and for the same reason, asserted sovereign immunity. The chief simply can't change the Constitution on his own.
But he can be enjoined against having elections that violate the 13th Amendment, right?
He can be enjoined from recognizing or enforcing an election, but what that does in substance is to paralyze the democracy in the nation, which I think, I go back to Hawaii v. Gordon, is the, you know, it puts a stop to public administration. It doesn't just, it's not like in Verizon, it's not a state rate commission operating as that was, Judge Garland, under a federal law, the Federal Deregulation Act, which I think Judge Rehnquist noted, certainly Judge Souter did in his dissent.
You're smiling when you say that.
Yes. I think it was Judge Souter.
Hard to rely on a dissent.
Right, I know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you both.